Time to talk sports on WNTK 99.7 FM, New London, New Hampshire, WUVR 98.9 FM, 1490 AM in Lebanon, New Hampshire. This is Saturday Sports Talk, your weekly update of what's been happening around the Upper Valley in sports. It's been quite an eventful week, I should say, highlighted perhaps by a 16-year-old's accomplishment halfway around the world. Springfield, New Hampshire resident Kearsarge High School student, I should say, Vera Rivard, completing a swim of the English Channel on Tuesday. Got done close to midnight on the shores of France, something that was easily monitorable online. Haven't had a chance to talk to her personally, but did interact with her mother through email and Facebook, and we'll talk a little bit about that adventure as we continue on the program today. Rules are in place. Schedule is all set. The strangest season ever of Vermont high school football is ready to get going real soon with the start of fall practices on Tuesday. We'll look ahead to what 7-on-7 football is going to be about. How do you go about playing it? How do you make it as non-contact as possible, for lack of a better way of putting it, to help with the mitigation of coronavirus and those efforts? We said goodbye to Chris Knight for the coming season for Dartmouth Benz basketball. Got a chance to talk to him this week after announcing that he was going in the NCAA transfer portal following Achilles heel surgery. Those and other things as well, and you're welcome to set the tone as well with a phone call to the office, well, to the studio, the mothership as we call it, where Tyler is eagerly awaiting the ringing of the bell. 888-299-3151 is the phone number for you. Rich and Woody, allegedly, could be anybody. Somebody shows up around 10 o'clock. They do Valley Buzz for 2 hours, and it takes you up until about 12 o'clock. Red Sox baseball continuing with a series with the Toronto Blue Jays tonight after a split yesterday, which is something we're going to detail right now, because not everything that happened in the world of sports on Friday night made it into Saturday morning's newspaper. We are going to read about it. I think we have all realized that the Boston Red Sox season has devolved into one where it's now time to look what's in the system and see what the potential is for the future. If you can have one game in which to announce your presence with authority, then a young man by the name of Yairo Munoz certainly did that yesterday for the Red Sox, playing out in left field for both halves of a 7-inning doubleheader with the Toronto Blue Jays. Munoz went 3-for-3 in the opening game, an 8-7 loss, 3-for-4 in the 3-2 victory in the nightcap, both games you heard on WNTK. And yeah, not a bad day's work for somebody who hadn't seen a whole lot of action in the majors. You may not have heard the name before, because his acquisition by the Red Sox came at a time when the coronavirus was just beginning to rage. He was signed as a free agent back on the 24th of March. That was 17 days after the St. Louis Cardinals had let him go, and 12 days after the Major League Baseball poobahs paused the season because of the pandemic. And his departure from St. Louis came under somewhat controversial circumstances. He had a hamstring injury in spring training, went home to the Dominican Republic rather than having an MRI, reportedly was unhappy with his playing time situation with the Cardinals. That ultimately forced his release. Red Sox took advantage of it, added him to their summer camp roster, kept him in their alternate training site down at Pawtucket, Rhode Island, but with so many injuries and the season basically lost by now, opportunity for him to play some action, and he certainly made the most of it yesterday. 6 hits altogether, really promising to see somebody who's really hot. Red Sox manager Ron Renicki said, good thing to see from the Sox on a otherwise desultory back half of the season. In that 3-2 victory, Sox scored in the second, third, and fifth innings and held off a late rally from Toronto. Matt Barnes getting his fourth save of the season for the Sox to hold that one down. The key play or misplay in the opening game loss, an error by right fielder Alex Verdugo losing a ball in the sun late in the contest that helped the Blue Jays to a big inning and eventually get a big lead en route to that victory. Sox with 13 wins on the season. They have 13-27 record. If it weren't for the Pittsburgh Pirates, they'd be the worst team in baseball right now. But we have already gotten past that point as the Red Sox and Toronto get ready to play more baseball. 6:30 broadcast time on WNTK 99.7 FM down in New London coming up later on tonight. Doubleheaders up the wazoo. And if I'm not mistaken, I'm looking at the scores posted on the MLB.com website. Yesterday, if it wasn't the first day out of the season in which there was no game postponed because of the virus or weather or any reason, It's one of the few. Doubleheader with the Twins and the Tigers. Twins got the opener 2-0, lost in the nightcap 3-2. That game went 8 innings. Twin bill for the Reds and the Pirates. A split there as well. Reds 4-2 in the opener, Pirates 4-3 in the nightcap. Nats and Braves played 2. That was a split as well, as the Braves took the opener 7-1, Nationals 10-9 in the nightcap. Guess what? Yankees and Orioles, they also split a doubleheader yesterday. Yanks 6-5 in the opener that went 9 innings, and the Orioles taking the nightcap 6-3. In what appear to be single games, the Marlins lose to Tampa Bay 5-4. Phillies over the Mets 5-3. Milwaukee beat the Indians 7-1. Terry Francona still not healthy enough to manage the Indians, although reports this week that he was doing better from his gastro surgery of the past few weeks. White Sox continue to play very well. They beat the Royals 7-4. Cubs top the Cardinals 4-1. Angels beat the Astros. Score there was 6-5. Went 11 innings in that case. Seattle 6, Texas 3. The Dodgers beat Colorado 10-6. They are the first team to 30 wins this season, and their 30-10 start marks the matches the best in franchise history over 40 games. San Diego still red hot. They beat Oakland 7-0, and the D-backs over the Giants. Score there was 6-5. The standing situation in the AL East: Toronto, or I should say Tampa Bay, still leads the point. They are up on the Yankees and Toronto by 5 games. The White Sox lead a logjam in the Central, half game up on Cleveland and Minnesota. Oakland in front of the AL West, although Houston has cut that gap down to 2 games. NL East, to no surprise, Atlanta leading the way, Philadelphia 2 back. Miami, bit of a surprise, 4.5 back, but they are a game under 500 and still have a lot of contests to make up from their coronavirus tests early, the positives early in the season. Milwaukee and St. Louis chasing the Cubs, 4.5 back in both cases. And as good as the Padres are, they just can't seem to make up any ground on the LA Dodgers. It's a 6-game gap between those two, but you can expect them both to make the playoffs when that gets started. The Boston Celtics, the victims of a last-second three-pointer that required a cross-court pass over Taco Fall with a half-second left on the clock. Well, they'll try to get their act back in order again this evening as they continue their Eastern Conference semifinal. Even with that one-point loss to Toronto the other night, Celtics go into tonight's fourth game with a 2-1 lead in that series. On the scoreboard from last night, the Houston Rockets opened up their Western Conference series with the Los Angeles Lakers and got a combined 83 points from Eric Gordon, Russell Westbrook, and James Harden in a 112-97 victory. And the team that, if they didn't have the best record in the regular season, certainly was among the best teams in the NBA prior to the pandemic, the Milwaukee Bucks. They are one game out from being swept out of the Eastern Conference semifinals. The Heat outscored Milwaukee 40-13 in the fourth quarter. Miami beat Milwaukee last night 115-100. NBA starting to hand out its season-ending awards, all based on voting on play from before the pandemic. LA Clippers' Montrezl Harris named the sixth man of the season yesterday, and Ja Morant of the Memphis Grizzlies chosen as the rookie of the year. Mike Woodson, the only former coach of the New York Knicks to win a playoff series in the last 2 decades, in fact, the last one to even reach the postseason, is back with the Knicks. He's going to be an assistant with new coach Tom Thibodeau on his staff. Women's National Basketball Association winding down. The ladies had some action last night, and if I could manage to get my computer to actually line up on the scores from last night, I could tell you that Washington beat Chicago 79-69, Minnesota over Dallas 88-75, Seattle 90-89 over the LA Sparks. The WNBA tournament has another week or so to go. Top 8 teams out of the 12, regardless of conference, will make the playoffs. 6 positions already clinched, 5 of them in the West. Connecticut Sun in position to possibly make it into the tournament as well. Well, Torrey Krug would like to be with the Boston Bruins, but he said on Thursday that as he looks for a longer-term contract, he's not going to give the Bruins a hometown free agent discount. Quote, "I'm very opposed to that," he said to NHL.com of a 1-year contract. "I've bet on myself. I've taken shorter-term deals, less amount of money my whole career. This is my time in terms of my value at its peak. I have the ability. I'm in a position now where I need to make the most of it." Although the 29-year-old said he would like to stay with the Boston Bruins, he can become an unrestricted free agent with a 4-year contract worth $5.25 million annually about to expire. NHL action last night. 2 teams moving on to set up the Western Conference Finals. You've never heard the name Joel Kivranta before, but you did yesterday. The kid had a hat trick Having only played 11 regular season games, he became the first player in the NHL to have a Game 7 hat trick since some dude named Wayne Gretzky back in 1993. His winner in overtime made Dallas a 5-4 victor over Colorado to take that series 4-3. And Vegas dominated Vancouver 3-0 last night. The Knuckleheads only got 14 shots on goal, but it took until a Shea Theodore blue line wrister with about 6.5 minutes left in the game before Vegas finally dented the net and finally went on to the 3-0 win to take that series in 7 games. Only series remaining, Islanders and Flyers. They're going to play Game 7 tonight in Toronto at 7:30. Winner of that set will play Tampa Bay in the Eastern Conference Finals. The Western Final will start on Sunday night between Dallas and Vegas, so theoretically the East would go on Monday. All games from here on out, from the conference championships and through the Stanley Cup Finals, will be played in Edmonton as hotel time is wrapping up in Toronto. News from the National Football League. If Adrian Peterson wants to play another 4 or 5 seasons, as he thinks he is capable of doing, he'll have to do it someplace else. The Washington Football Team. I've always thought they should have changed that to Washington Team / Football, and then their initials could have been WTF, which would be certainly appropriate. Anyway, Washington cut the 35-year-old yesterday as they prepared for the cut-down day that goes on a little bit later on today. Peterson admitting that it came as a surprise. He said he was having a strong camp, but according to the Washington poobahs, they felt that a younger running back core would serve the team better heading into the coming season. Josh Rosen looks to be the odd quarterback out again. Reports are that Miami is waiving the former first-round pick after unsuccessful attempts to trade him in the last couple of days. It'd be the second time in as many years as Rosen has been cut after just a one-season stay. He was selected number 10 out of UCLA by Arizona in the 2018 draft, but then they dealt him the next year for a second-round pick. The only cuts we know of officially from the New England Patriots: wide receiver Mohamed Sanu, defensive lineman Michael Barnett, and cornerback Michael Jackson. Everybody in the NFL has to drop their rosters down to 53 by 4 o'clock this afternoon to prepare for the start of the regular season in a little bit less than a week, actually. Next Thursday is the alleged start of the season. U.S. Open going on strong without fans at Flushing Meadows. Highlights from the women's third round yesterday saw a couple of young Americans, unseeded Shelby Rogers along with 28th seeded Jennifer Brady, picking up straight set victories. Among more familiar names, 6th seeded Petra Kvitova won in straight sets, as did 17th seed and former champ Angelique Kerber. Naomi Osaka has been struggling to dispatch opponents in quick fashion, and that certainly happened again yesterday, but she did pull through with a 3-set victory in her third round match, beating Ukraine's Marta Kostyuk. On the men's side of third round action yesterday, no real huge surprises, with the one exception of 4th-seeded Greek Stefanos Tsitsipas, who loses in 5 sets to Borna Koric from Slovakia. Among other winners, straight set victory for Novak Djokovic and for a 4-set win for German Alex Zverev in third round play at Flushing Meadows. Kentucky Derby is being held at Churchill Downs today, about 4 months later than normal, rather than the first Saturday of May, first Saturday of September instead. 'Tis the Law remains the overwhelming favorite at 6-5 on morning odds. You'd have to go to Honor AP at 8-1 to see anybody even close as far as a challenger is concerned. A lot of the action, at least among race favorites, will be on the outside, as Honor AP, 'Tis the Law, and 9-1 Authentic are in the outside 3 spots, 16, 17, 18, in what is actually a 16-horse field. There have been a couple of scratches this week. Finnick the Fierce, which was in the number 1 hole, and King Guillermo at the number 6 spot, both have scratched for the race. The only other horse in the field at less than double-digit odds, 1,000 words at 9-1, going out of the 10 hole for the race this afternoon. 'Tis the Law, of course, won the Belmont back in June, was very impressive in taking the Travers last month at Saratoga, certainly looking like the favorite this afternoon in Louisville. Major League Soccer back in action with 4 matches today. New England Revolution will be off until tomorrow night when they visit the Chicago Fire. New York Red Bulls looking for a new coach. They cut loose Chris Armas yesterday. Nice to see the National Women's Soccer League has a fall schedule. These are the folks who had the first live team sports in the United States in the wake of the pandemic, and they were talking after that tournament was done that they wouldn't play any more soccer this year, but the NWSL has set up a pod system for the next 6 weeks. It's 9 teams broken down into 3 geographic areas, and they'll play 4 matches total heading into the middle of August. Action will begin today with, I believe it's the Washington Spirit taking on, I knew who it was before, Sky Blue FC out of New Jersey, playing a little bit later on this afternoon. PGA Championship, one round down so far, and the three guys at the top of the FedEx Cup standings are the three guys at the top of the leaderboard at East Lake. Dustin Johnson, John Rahm, both with rounds of 65 yesterday, and rather through two rounds. They are at, that doesn't make sense. One round done so far. 67, 65 is what it says here, but both are listed as 13 under par. Justin Thomas at 11 under par is two shots off the pace. And NASCAR begins the playoffs this weekend. The Labor Day tradition of the Southern 500 down at Darlington tomorrow night as 16 drivers begin pursuit of the NASCAR Cup Series Championship. That does it for Read About It here on WNTK WUVR. A long swim done well. We'll talk about Vera Rivard's day in the English Channel when we come back here on WNTK and WUVR. Now, the radio advises that you stick around here for a little while for Live and Local on WNTK, WUVR. This is Saturday Sports Talk with Greg Fennell from the Valley News at, what time do we have here, 9:25? I used to have that on my phone here through the atomic clock I adopted many, many years ago. So, yes, 9:25, which means we're about 35 minutes away from Rich and Woody or some combination therein for Valley Buzz up till 12. Red Sox baseball, so continue a series with Toronto. 7:30 is the first pitch tonight, 6:30 start time on 99.7 FM. Talking a variety of things today, 7-on-7 football in Vermont, the loss of Chris Knight, absence of a boys soccer coach at Woodstock High, all coming up. But really, the thing that has kind of moved the needle for me and for the Valley News in a lot of ways this week was the accomplishment of one Vera Rivard, I believe she's going to be a junior at Kearsarge High, 16 years of age. Splits her time between Springfield, New Hampshire, and Derby, Vermont, because of her interest in long-distance open-water swimming. It's something that she's been doing for a very long time, hence the second home up in Derby to be right on Lake Memphremagog and the many distance events involved with the Kingdom Games up there. But for some time now, Rivard has made it well known that she has interest in completing what's called the Triple Crown of open water swimming. The first one of those she completed last month, actually in July, the 20 Bridges of Manhattan, which is a 28.5-mile swim around Manhattan Island. Got that done. The other one to be done is the Catalina Island swim, which is about 20 miles, leaving the Pacific coast of California to get to Santa Catalina Island. Hasn't been scheduled. But the one in between, and the one that certainly has generated a lot of notoriety for Vera, came on Tuesday, when she did the 21-mile, or what is supposed to ordinarily in a straight line be a 21-mile swim across the English Channel, going from roughly Dover to Wissant Beach, which is east, or make it west-southwest of Calais on the northern shore of France. That's the one that obviously generates a lot of imagination and people can relate to, because it's something that human beings have been attempting for almost 150 years. The Channel Swimming Association, which is one of a couple of groups that oversees attempts to cross the channel, has records dating back to 1875, and its annals list, oh good lord, go back here, I can see 2,500 successful swims since 1875, if you go online to channelswimmingassociation.com. The neat thing about it was it's gotten to the point with the internet that you could monitor this in real time. Just keep in mind that there's a 5-hour time difference. They're 5 hours sooner than we are. So although she was scheduled to hit the water at about 3:30 in the morning, our time on Tuesday was actually 8:30 when she was scheduled, and 9:30 roughly when it actually happened. Now, if you go to the Channel Swimming Association website and go to swims and then results, you get the list of everybody who has crossed the channel successfully and in some cases unsuccessfully, whether it's an individual or a relay team of 2, 3, 4, or 5, whatever. And if you go to a bunch of them over a certain amount of time, you realize something, that there is no way to swim in a straight line from England to France. The reasons are many. Tides have something to do with it. Naval traffic has a lot to do with it, or marine traffic has a lot to do with it. And when you are the pilot of a small fishing boat, as Peter Reed was, a gentleman from Folkestone Harbor to the southwest of Dover, one of the Channel Swing Association's assigned boats to monitor and travel with people who are attempting the channel swim, you obviously are not going to be the biggest boat on the water. So you go and look at the route that Vera took, as mapped out on a version of Google Maps, and you'll see that it sort of looks like a reverse letter S. She headed out from, what was it called? Samfireho Beach in Dover, and then immediately seemed to make a left-hand turn, was going due east, seemingly towards Sweden, before turning straight south and making the most of her mileage that way during the day. Then there was this another left-hand turn heading in the general direction of Wissant Beach, where she finally made landfall at 11:48 local time, 6:48 Eastern time, on Tuesday. The shortest route, shortest straight line route from Folkestone Harbor to what is called Cap Gris-Nez, which is a small jut of land out into the English Channel, west-southwest of Calais, that's about 21 miles. But because of the meandering route that she took and the meandering route that most swimmers take in a channel attempt, she actually swam closer to 33 miles. I found another marine monitoring website that actually had a tool on it that you could measure distances with. So by going from the point-by-point pings from telemetry from the Rowena, Peter Reed's boat that accompanied Vera on the trip, I just did the math in my head as I was going, so I came up with a rough tally of 33 miles. Now, can you imagine swimming that long? I don't think any of us could. I mean, I have a hard time thinking past walking on a treadmill for half an hour. And this was for 14 hours and 10 minutes. That was her unofficial time. So for more than half of a calendar day, shall we say, she was in the water, constant motion, trying to keep from drinking the English Channel. Fortunately, had a nice day. Temperatures in the air were in the 60-degree range. The water temperature was around 64 degrees. Not super warm, but not super cold. And the waves, according to telemetry, were breaking at about a foot, maybe a little bit more. So it wasn't perfect calm, but it certainly was a lot better than it could have been. It's amazing to think what Vera and her family had to do to make this possible. The whole cost, according to the family, is about $15,000. They have a couple of sponsorships from local companies. A swimwear company has offered some sponsorship as well. That's covered about 40% of the $15,000. There's still a lot to be raised to pay for it. Why so expensive? Well, obviously, you have to hire the boat to serve as your guardian, so to speak, as you do that. So you've got at least three crew members on that, not to mention your own family members coming along to help out. Vera had her mother and her sister Margaret as well. On top of that, you have to pay for the airfare, obviously, to get from here to England. And then to further complicate matters, of course, the coronavirus. It required a two-week quarantine, for Vera, her mother, and sister. They found themselves a nice flat in Dover, downtown in Dover, and had to spend a couple of weeks there. And then on top of that, you have to get the word from the Channel Swimming Association, from the boat that you have hired, with limited advanced knowledge, what day you're actually going to be going. They arrived in Dover on August 8th. The quarantine ended on the 22nd. Vera was targeting a window of August 24th to 29th, but the weather during that time was not favorable. They finally got the word on Monday, with I think about 12 hours notice, that they would be hitting the water at 8:30 on Tuesday morning. It looked like the weather was going to be good. If the weather continued to be foul, I don't know how long they were planning on staying to make this possible. I would have thought there would have been a drop dead time in which they would have to return to New Hampshire and get on with life and get on with school and things like that. But she got the word, and from what I could tell, I have not talked to them directly, but from what I could tell from monitoring online, the situation could not have been better than it turned out to be. The only problems were Vera's mother, Darcy, was providing some updates on Facebook, but she had phone issues. You know, imagine that in the middle of the English Channel, getting information out. So even though you could see from the telemetry that it appeared she had been successful, you have to keep in mind the fact that, of course, these aren't amphibious boats. So if you're going to do a coast-to-coast or shore-to-shore swim, you're starting out on the shore while the boat's however far out in the water it has to be before you catch up to it. So what you see when you look at the map of how her route went, you don't see a red line that goes from coast to coast. You see a red line that starts offshore and ends offshore. So she still had to get, at the end of the swim, from wherever the boat was onto the beach at France, where, by the way, swimmers are encouraged not to encounter anybody because of coronavirus reasons. Just keep your distance, make your landfall, turn around, get back in the water, and then get back on the boat for the trip back, which, by the way, took about 3 hours. They did not return to Folkestone Harbor until somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 in the morning, Wednesday, local time, after everything was finished. But by the time they got back, both Darcy had posted on Facebook that the swim had been successful. Peter Reed had sent me an email confirming, in typical British fashion, that she was, quote-unquote, brilliant, and Vera had completed her swim. So congratulations to Vera. I know she has a lot of supporters through the Upper Valley Aquatic Club, where she is a competitive swimmer, mostly long-distance events, and obviously will be back in action when UVAC gets its meet schedule going again here, hopefully really soon. And it's my hope that sometime in the near future, I'll have a chance to sit down with her and learn a little bit more about the motivation behind this, because, as I said before, I have a hard time personally envisaging spending more than half an hour on a piece of exercise equipment. I cannot see myself doing anything for 14 straight hours except breathing and possibly talking. So in her case, an incredible feat, physical feat. I even got an email in response to our story from a gentleman in Chevy Chase, Maryland, who just happened to have seen the story rewritten by the Associated Press and wanted to just pass on the word to Vera how impressed she was, because he was somebody who had wanted to do the English Channel at some point and was not able to complete the task. So congratulations to Vera and her family. It's a really neat story, and hopefully we'll be able to expand on it sometime in the near future. Let's take a time out, and here at 9:36, we're going to come back and give you an idea of what 7-on-7 football in Vermont is all going to be about. Practices officially start on Tuesday. Schedules are out for the four teams in our listening area. We'll take a look at it when we come back on Saturday Sports Talk. Stick around. Well, I'm sorry to hear you say that, but it's going to be a gorgeous weekend for Labor Day, so maybe we could go for a bike ride. We'll see. Joey doesn't appear to be in a good mood at 9:40 on this Saturday for Labor Day weekend. This is Saturday Sports Talk. That was your mandatory Ramones here on SST. As we head on up toward the top of the hour and Valley Buzz, Red Sox baseball 6:30 tonight. Usually by now we are well into the high school season for fall. Might even have had our first batch of football games. In fact, we would have had our first batch of football games by now, with New Hampshire probably following suit this particular weekend. But as we are more than aware, unfortunately, this is not a normal circumstance, and we are still somewhat in a wait-and-see mode. But as of right now, Vermont and New Hampshire are scheduled to get their practices going on Tuesday for all sports. In what form some sports will be played still remains to be seen. Right now we're looking, I think, at tackle football for some places in New Hampshire, but in Vermont it's going to be dictated by the State Agency of Education and the Department of Health. 7-on-7, touch football, no tackle, limited physical contact, no state tournament. It's something. It's not making a lot of people happy, but it is at least something. And as of right now, games are supposed to begin on the final weekend of September, 25th and 26th, but even that remains in somewhat of a state of flux. That part of the situation should really not come as any sort of surprise. The thing that's thrown a little bit more fog on the whole situation is an announcement earlier this week by the Northern Vermont Athletic Conference, which oversees about 40 schools in the northern half of Vermont, that games will not start until the last week of September for soccer, field hockey, and volleyball. And it appears that has followed through with NVAC teams involved in 7-on-7 football. They wanted to spend a little more time to get things ready. Everything revolves around the step or stage situation as determined by Vermont Governor Phil Scott's folks. Right now, everybody is at step 2, which allows for practices but no competition beyond intra-squad scrimmages. Once everybody gets to step 3, then games would be allowed to happen. The folks in Vermont have been anticipating that step 3 would be called into play sometime around the 20th of September or possibly a couple of days sooner. That would allow for teams to get started. So practices, I think, are really, in all sports, are gearing up toward that date, but there is no guarantee that that date is going to come about. Now, earlier in the week, Sean Farrell, who oversees the Vermont Interscholastic Football League, he's the AD at Middlebury High School, set out what was meant to be the final draft of the schedule for 7-on-7 football. And the thing that's actually kind of interesting about it is that teams are still getting 9-game schedules. Now, I don't know if this means that varsities are going to play twice a week or if one date is a varsity, one is a JV date, because of the fact that we're not dealing with the physical contact that comes with football, and of course the aches and pains and injuries follow, that there may be a theory that these kids can get in a 9-game season. So if you play on a Friday, then your next game would be Tuesday. If you played on a Saturday, your next game would be on a Wednesday. And everything has been set up into 4 geographic pods, if you will, based around Burlington, Rutland, Hartford, and St. Johnsbury. Hartford, Woodstock, Windsor are all going to be in the same group with Bellows Falls, Brattleboro, and Springfield. And pretty much all of their games are going to be within that group, although Hartford has been allowed to maintain a date with Middlebury at the end of the season. Brattleboro, traditionally a rival with Mount Anthony, they're going to play a game at the end of the season as well. The schedule for Hartford is supposed to begin at Windsor on the 26th. And again, keep in mind what 7-on-7 football is. It is quarterback and receivers only. There is a center who will snap the ball to the quarterback, but everybody else is an eligible receiver. The center does not become one, but should a pass be intercepted, he is eligible to make a quote-unquote tackle, which of course is one or two hands touch. Incidental contact does not count. The Hartford schedule has them going to Windsor on the 26th, then Bellows Falls on the 30th, a home game with Bellows Falls on October 2nd, which is SAT week, and then Springfield at home, Springfield away, Woodstock away and home, Brattleboro at home on the 20th or 21st, and then at Middlebury on the 23rd or 24th. Windsor, after that Hartford date, would host Brattleboro, then go to Brattleboro, away and home with Bellows Falls, home and away with Springfield, home and away with Woodstock. And the Wasps, of course, who had that horrid season last year after graduating so much from an undefeated state championship season, they'll start at Bellows Falls on the 26th with home Springfield and away, Brattleboro away and home, Hartford home and away, and then Windsor away and home to finish off the campaign. Now, let's go back to that thing I was mentioning before about the Northern Vermont Athletic Conference pushing back the start of games until the last week of September. That's going to have an effect on football, as Oxbow is playing in a group with Linden, North Country, Spalding, St. Johnsbury, and Union 32. As of this time, Oxbow won't have games on the second week or the sixth week, or play date, I guess you could say. Now, whether that's because of just having 6 teams in the pod or because of the NVAC bumping things back and causing game cancellations, I'm not sure. You see that St. Johnsbury and Union 32, both NVAC members, don't have games on the first week, and in fact, U32 only has 4 on its entire schedule. So again, that could be a factor of the NVAC bumping things back, have some more rescheduling to do. We'll just have to kind of wait and see. And I'm looking forward. On Tuesday, my plan is to hit at least one football practice on the Vermont side of the river, possibly 2 if the timing works out, and just get a feel from the coaches and the kids on how they're going about preparing for this. 7-on-7 football is not like anything they don't do. Most programs have some sort of a 7-on-7 program in the summer. And in fact, some play in leagues in the summer just to make some semblance of football shape. Is it what we're used to seeing? Obviously not, because linemen are not going to be involved in their traditional capacity. They will be involved. Four-quarter games with 15-minute running time, the linemen are going to go up against the linemen in two of those quarters. It'll be quarterbacks and traditional receivers in the other two quarters as well. But it's interesting when you look at the rules, how they've adapted to make things work, for instance. Aside from the obvious things like facial covering required of everybody involved, mouth guards recommended, not necessarily required. Helmets, the only protective equipment that they're going to be allowed to wear, with the exception, obviously, of face, or rather the face covering or the mouth guard. All plays are passes. No fumbles. If a ball is fumbled, it's a dead ball. In fact, I sent Sean a question the other day asking if a ball is fumbled but caught in midair, can it be advanced? And he said no, balls that are fumbled are automatically dead and the offense maintains possession. Well, it makes sense, because what happens in a fumble? You get a scrum, which is exactly what you're trying to avoid through this this whole thing. There is some element of kicking game involved, although teams may kick off in each half, and after a score, play will still start at the offense's 30-yard line regardless of what happens. The whole idea having a kicking game just to help kickers and punters develop. Field goals are allowed. Points after touchdown are allowed. Quarterback has to throw the ball after 4 seconds. No rushing of the quarterback. It's kind of like what my friends and I used to play touch football in the street when we were kids. You had to count Mississippis before you could go after the quarterback. Well, they're not doing that. There's no Mississippis, no any state involved. The quarterback cannot be challenged. Obviously, no blocking and tackling. Extra points could either be by kick or by a pass. All sorts of stuff to keep in mind. Coverages, obviously, could be zone, could be man-to-man. There's no bumping at the line, no chucking, anything like that. So it's definitely a different animal. Because of that, there's going to be no postseason this year. It's in the annals. I think it's going to probably just show that nothing ever happened. What's meant to happen out of this is to give kids an opportunity to play something resembling football, to at least get some sort of experience, some sort of development, hopefully some fun out of it. As of right now, crowd sizes are limited to 150 at any sort of Vermont event. Maybe those will increase a little bit, but at least people will be able to come and see on a school-by-school basis. You'll have to check with your school to see what the ticket situation is, how that is handled. I could see sort of like a reservation system like you're seeing with some of the gyms around here, some of the special needs facilities like Spark are doing things like that as well. So check with your school on that. It will be strange, but get ready for it, because that's how Vermont's going to approach football this year. Formal practices in both states start on Tuesday, so also we'll be checking into what our football schools on the New Hampshire side are doing. Right now, it's looking like tackle, although I've heard that Fall Mountain is not going to field a team this year. Mascoma, Stevens, Newport, Lebanon, Hanover all in something of a scheduling pod, so we'll end up seeing a lot of local rivalries going up against each other. And what's going to happen for Vermont, I should say New Hampshire playoffs, I don't know. I sent an email off to Jeff Collins, the executive director of the NHIAA, earlier this week, and his response was it hasn't been finalized as of yet. Still a lot to happen, even though the practices are going to be starting just 72 hours from now. A lot to see. Coming up on 9:50, and we'll look at some miscellaneous stuff as well, including departures on the playing and coaching front, right here on Saturday Sports Talk. Stick around. A little thought from the police here on Saturday Sports Talk at 9:54. From the beginning, Simple Minds, Elvis Costello's Classic Radio, Flock of Seagulls, your mandatory Ramones, I Don't Want to Walk Around with You. Divinals and the Police from Ghost in the Machine. That's your tunage here on Saturday Sports Talk as we look toward the end of things today. Speaking of the ends of things, sad news out of Woodstock Union High School from my perspective that Tom Avellino is not going to be coaching anything at the school apparently anymore, but for reasons that nobody's willing to talk about. In the process of just looking to see where things were standing in their search for an athletic director the other day, I came across an advertisement on the school spring website for an interim varsity boys soccer coach. That is something that Tom had coached for the past 8 years. So I got a call over to him, and all he would say was that he wasn't coaching anymore. When I asked him about boys basketball, which he picked up last year, he said, no, I'm not doing that. He has been a JV baseball coach. He's coached girls tennis, JV boys basketball, all sorts of stuff for 20 years, but for whatever reason that he declined to comment on, and that Superintendent Shelley Souza would not detail, and I didn't even get a return message from Principal Garen Smale. So it's on them for creating speculation on why Tom Avellino is no longer coaching. It's a sad thing because Tom's a good guy. I've really enjoyed working with him. He's always accessible, always has information that I need, and usually has it maybe not at his fingertips, but certainly is willing to share it. So to have him say that he no longer is coaching and is not going to be talking about it is very disappointing. Woodstock, under Avellino as a boys soccer coach, made three state championship games in Vermont Division II. Unfortunately, lost all three of them, two of them on penalty kicks, but a very impressive 87-34-13 record in those eight seasons for a guy who never even played the game. We did a feature on him back in the basketball season when he took on the varsity program at a time of great uncertainty at Woodstock. Then athletic director Caron Pinckney had hired a gentleman by the name of Jamal Hughes to be the new boys basketball coach in the wake of a parting of company with Joel Carey, but Hughes ultimately dropped the job before even starting with Woodstock when his college alma mater, Vermont Tech, needed a coach, and he took that job. So Tom stepped up from the junior varsity. The team went 2-18 last winter, obviously had its struggles despite having some talent, but a lot of success on the soccer field, and Woodstock doesn't have that expertise anymore. Also departing, Chris Knight. We may have talked about that a little bit last week, but didn't get a chance to talk to Chris until midweek. Chris, of course, the top player on a what appeared to be an improving Dartmouth men's basketball team last year. He was a second-team All-Ivy selection for the second straight year, double-digit scorer, team leader, the guy through whom the offense pretty much rotated on any given night, and a key element in a five wins in six games in league play for Dartmouth late in the season that propelled them into the conversation for what turned out to be the canceled Ivy League tournament. Dartmouth didn't qualify, lost their last two games, but still provided some promise. And when Brendan Berry in March confirmed that he was going to return to Dartmouth after going through the NCAA transfer portal and winnowing choices down to Temple and Wake Forest, that really, I think, led to a certain sense of optimism around Dartmouth men's basketball that maybe a corner was turning. But Chris tore his, or ruptured his left Achilles tendon late July, had the surgery. We talked on Wednesday. He seems to be doing well, says he's feeling better, but of course facing a 6 to 9 month rehabilitation process. Achilles tendon tears and ruptures are a long thing to come back from. So as a protection for himself, he has entered the portal. He's going to look the situation over. Basically, in his situation, he has only two choices. If he wants to finish his athletic career at Dartmouth, he has to space out the remainder of his classes over the better part of 2 years. He is a senior. He is on track to graduate for a government degree in the spring. If he wants to graduate with his class, then he has to forego the last year of playing basketball at Dartmouth and transfer someplace else to get that last year of eligibility. And he admitted that, you know, going for a master's wouldn't be the worst thing in the world for him to do in the wake of his government degree. So I see that as a possible option for him. Where that could end up being, that's only a process that's just getting started. He said he hopes to make the call on what he wants to do by spring, which is basically when he's going to have to do it, because he'll have to probably have maybe one more term of classes he's going to be on campus for the fall before he can start thinking about stretching things out or just going and getting his diploma. coming up in June. That does it for this edition of Saturday Sports Talk. Thank you for tuning in for this particular Saturday. You got Rich and Woody coming up next with Valley Buzz, and then Red Sox baseball 6:30 with Toronto tonight on NTK. I'm Greg Fennell from the Valley News. You've been listening to Saturday Sports Talk on WNTK and WUVR. It's Labor Day weekend, folks, so please socially distance, wear your masks, be smart, and have a great weekend, everybody. Take care.